everyone, and welcome to the Dallas Soccer Show. I'm Dustin Nation. I'm here with Tristan Vick. How's it going, Tristan?
It's going great. I have air conditioning.
Hallelujah.
I know. It sucked. Last week was awful. Hey. So I'm glad to be back. Sorry I missed the Reggie Cannon interview.
No, I had a great time with that. I listened to it several... I listened to it editing it, and I went back and I actually listened to it again in the car. And I thought Reggie was a great guest. But yep. We also have a great guest tonight with Sebastian Abbott, and we'll get to that interview here in a bit after we talk a little bit about FC Dallas's big away win on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it. I know that you were at the solo premiere, so we both got great experiences.
Mistakes were made in scheduling.
Yeah, well, FC Dallas, if you didn't know, for some reason... We went up there and beat Toronto FC. Jesse Gonzalez got the start again, which I think is probably a pretty big headline for most FC Dallas fans. Had some big saves, was very active. I think Giovinco has had a lot of buzz about him recently, but he just, for whatever reason, wasn't able to get past Jesse Gonzalez.
Jesse had his number.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was a great performance by the defense. Matt Hedges had a pretty bad foul on Giovinco to give away a penalty. Late tackle, but ultimately Gonzalez bailed him out. And I kind of like these 1-0 like clean sheets. That's very, I don't know, it's just very clean and crisp. And anytime you limit the goals, it's going to be a good outcome. So we've got a busy week with the California teams, and luckily for us, the Galaxy have quite a few players away for the World Cup friendlies that are going on right now. So we're going to catch them on kind of a off night where they have Dos Santos brothers. They're not going to be able to bring out some of their best players, which will make it for a...
Darn.
A little... Yeah, no, exactly. It'll be really nice, actually. I mean, just in general, but also it'll be a nice way to kind of test this team going from Toronto on Friday night back home, and then they're heading off, and they'll be playing in LA tomorrow on Wednesday night. You're probably not hearing this. You're probably hearing this on Thursday just after this happened. But in that case, check it out on Saturday when they come back to Frisco and they catch LAFC, who also is missing quite a few players for World Cup and friendly duty. So there's a lot of soccer to be had. And if you can't catch any of those matches, check out the U.S. national team matches. You can see a lot of FC Dallas alumni on those teams as well. So
yes,
really no excuse not to watch.
It's a good 10 days or so of soccer between Friday night and this Champions League on Saturday, which I missed, I'm kind of glad now as a Liverpool fan.
Yeah, your scheduling is really bad.
I had a rough couple days with Google Calendar. Me and Google Calendar.
You got to talk to that Google Calendar guy. Yeah, no, it's going to be a ton of soccer going on. And then obviously be sure to tell your wives, girlfriends, computer game friends, whatever you do that takes up time from soccer, to go away until mid-July, because the World Cup starts in like 20 days or something. So we've got that going on too. But yeah, there's a lot of soccer to be had.
And speaking of World Cup, we've got the World Cup coming up in 2020 in Qatar, or 2022 in Qatar. And so that's...
I'm still not convinced that happens, but...
Well... Qatar's a flashpoint, and we just so happen to have on an expert in the Qatari search for talent. Tristan, you want to tell us a little bit about that, how that conversation went?
Yeah, so we talked to Sebastian Abbott, who was the foreign correspondent for the Associated Press over in the Middle East, worked as the AP bureau chief over in Pakistan, did a lot of work with all the activity going on over there in the Middle East. But the nice thing about it is he's got a lot of experience playing soccer. And so he played for Princeton under Bob Bradley. And that's obviously quite the cool little story there. But we talked to him primarily about soccer development in Qatar. His new book that just came out is called The Away Game, The Epic Search for Soccer's Next Superstars. And it centers around the Qatar Foundation, which is the private investment arm of the Qatar royal family, and their search to try to find, basically create the biggest talent search to bolster their national team as they prepare for the 2022 World Cup. It's a pretty great read. Dustin, you've done the book, and so we kind of got him to go through some of the background behind it. But if you're not familiar with this story, all you have to do is, A, you should check out the book, because it's a good putting a face to these tales of corruption that you hear is rarely done these days, but now you actually have it in this book.
And there's plenty of stories about the kids that they pull up and how the conditions that they come from. And it's just a really good story about humans and as well as soccer. So plenty to digest in that book. So go pick it up. It's on Amazon.
Yeah, it's on Amazon, and there's an audiobook as well.
Yep.
But it's basically, we get into that, and then we start talking about development here at home in America as far as youth development goes. So if any of that interests you, we don't get into like naming who the next great American players are, but we do get into a lot of the developments over the past couple years that hopefully have us on the right track. So check it out. And next week we'll be back to review probably two FC Dallas games and maybe talk a little bit about the US men's national team.
All right. Without further ado, here's our discussion with Sebastian Abbott. You're listening to the Dallas Soccer Show with Dustin Nation and Tristan Vick. Hey, Sebastian, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I just got done reading your book and I really enjoyed it. I thought there was a lot of different things going on. And so I'm really glad you could join us to talk about it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I look forward to talking about it with you.
So, let's start off talking about you and how you ended up writing this book. I know you were educated in economics and public policy at Princeton and Harvard, and you ended up in writing in for the AP in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and then now you're writing about soccer. So talk a little bit about how your life took those turns and how you ended up going from, you know, being a public policy studying public policy into writing about soccer.
Yeah, I have a pretty varied background. After I graduated from college, I actually went to work on Wall Street, which I did for about a half a dozen years, and towards the end of that time, always had a bit of wanderlust, and decided to sort of quit my job, traveled around the world for a bit, had always thought about becoming a foreign correspondent. And in between my 2 years in graduate school, I went and freelanced in Lebanon and Syria and just had a blast. And so I thought, you know, if I could get somebody to pay me to do this, this would be a pretty good gig. And after grad school, I ended up moving to Cairo and working for the AP. In Cairo for a few years covering the Middle East, and ultimately then moved on to Pakistan, covered Pakistan and Afghanistan, spent time in Libya with the rebels when they were fighting Gaddafi. But when I was living in Cairo, it's been quite an adventure. but when I was living in Cairo back in 2007, I was running on the gym one day and a commercial comes on the TV. And it shows this gleaming new sports academy in Qatar called Aspire. And there was a boy juggling a soccer ball in the commercial. And so it piqued my interest. I've been a soccer fan my entire life. I've played since I was 5 years old, lucky enough to play under Bob Bradley at Princeton before he became the U.S. national team coach. And so I was just curious. I went home and Googled Aspire Academy. And it just so happened this was when they launched this program, Football Dreams, the largest talent search in soccer history. In that first year, they held tryouts for over 400,000 boys in seven African countries. And so I went and spent a few days with the first class of kids from Africa when they were in Doha for their final tryout. in the beginning of 2008 and wrote an article about it for the AP. And even then I thought this would be an amazing book or movie or documentary or something, but wasn't really in a position to do it at the time. And so ultimately moved to Pakistan, had a bunch of adventures, but this Football Dreams program always stuck with me. I always wondered what had happened to, you know, those talented African kids who I'd spent a few days with in Doha. And so the end of 2013, I was looking for a new challenge and wondered if anybody had ever written a book about Football Dreams, and discovered nobody had. And so contacted agents in New York and asked them if they thought there'd be a market for this. And they said, sounds amazing. And so I actually quit my job at the AP at the beginning of 2014 and embarked on what would become a 4-year odyssey that took me to 10 different countries on 4 different continents to research and write this book. So it was an amazing experience, and it's an unbelievable story.
Yeah. On the surface, there's so much romance and grandeur in the whole thing. And so, you know, we'll get into a little bit more beyond the surface stuff, but, mm-hmm. so your book starts off and, you're following Joseph Colomer.
Colomer, yeah.
And he's going around. He's, like you said, he's looking for all this African talent. He finds 75 kids from the continent.
Basically the way it worked was, every year they would hold tryouts. For example, the first year it started with 7 African countries. Ultimately it ballooned to nearly 20, inside and outside in Africa. But the first year was just 7 African countries. And what they would do is they had a network of 6,000 people that worked with them on the ground in Africa. To put that in perspective for readers, that's the same number of people that work on an aircraft carrier. So just an absolute massive network of people that would help set up these tryouts at, you know, dirt fields all across the continent. And they would send in foreign scouts who would hold tryouts for kids, 13-year-old boys, at all these fields all across these countries. And in each country, they would pick 50 best kids, mm-hmm. and then bring them to the capital of that country for a 4-day tryout. And then in each country, they pick sort of the best 3 to 5 kids, and then bring sort of about the top 50 to Doha for a almost month long final tryout. And then from that, they'd pick around 20 that they'd put in this academy and train to become professional. So it was an absolutely massive undertaking.
Yeah. Out of all those kids, you kind of zone in on 5-6 of them, mm-hmm. and you know, really tell their stories in depth. Which of those stories of the kids that you covered, which one's the most compelling to you?
Yeah, they were all very compelling. I mean, compelling in different ways. I mean, one of the boys that, you know, definitely stood out to me was this tall, sort of strapping striker from Senegal named Ibrahima Drame. He's from a town in southern Senegal called Ziguinchor, which is on this sort of massive, mighty Casamance River. It's a fishing town. And he had a really tough childhood. His parents split up when he was very young, and his mom didn't have a lot of money to raise him. And so she ended up basically selling kind of small plastic bags of peanuts and oranges on a wooden table by the side of the road just to try and have enough money to feed her kids. And their life got even harder sort of soon after she split up with her husband. They lived in a mud house that collapsed in a rainstorm, so they didn't even have a place to live. And ended up, he and his 3 siblings and his mother all went and lived in one room of his grandmother's house. And it just touched me because, you know, his older brother, who was only 14 at the time, had to drop out of school to go work in the local port with the fishermen to try and earn enough money for basic things like rice and cooking oil. And Ibrahima would help out a little bit as well. But his real passion was soccer, and he would play kind of every minute he could. And luckily for him, his uncle had sort of an informal soccer school that was around the corner from his house, and he would play every afternoon there. And it quickly became apparent that he was a real talent. And so when Qatar came and told his uncle that they wanted to hold tryouts and were looking for the best young kids in Senegal, he knew that Ibrahima was the one in his school that had the best chance. And the scouts came to his town, and he wowed them, and he got selected for the final tryout in Doha. And the thing that really struck me about Ibrahima's story was that right before he was about to go to Doha for this final tryout, he found out that his brother was going to take this really risky journey to the Canary Islands by sort of rickety wooden boats. Thousands of Senegalese were trying to make these journeys at the time, and hundreds had already died. And so he went to his brother and he said, look, you know, I don't think it's worth it. You know, I've been selected to this final tryout at this academy. I think if I make it, everything's going to change for the family. And so his brother didn't end up going. And I think he actually probably saved his brother's life. But then you think about this young kid who's about to fly off to Qatar, a country he's never heard of, a country that really he's going to arrive and realize it was a place he could never have imagined. But he doesn't just go with the pressure of, you know, trying to compete with all these elite African kids who are there trying to get a place in the academy. He goes with the weight of his entire family on his shoulders. You know, he knows that this is make or break for his family. If he can get in, if he can make it to Europe and become a professional, it's not only going to transform the life of his immediate family, but, you know, his extended family and even perhaps his community back home in Senegal. And so this was, you know, a very poignant story that, you know, for Ibrahima in particular. But you saw a lot of kids like this who grow up, you know, spending hours and hours playing on dirt fields in Africa, and all of them are dreaming of making it to Europe. And they all go with that dream that if they're successful, they can transform the lives of their family and sort of raise everyone up.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories in your book that are similar as far as, like, you know, just the human condition that's going on in Africa and trying mm-hmm. to, like, everybody's trying to raise themselves up out of there. And I think for me, one of the most, compelling stories is one of the ones you start the book off with the, mm-hmm. with Colomer on a dock mm-hmm. on the Niger River Delta. Mm-hmm. And he's got, you know, armed guards that are handing him off to armed rebels, and mm-hmm. like the government and the rebels, they both just want their kids to be able to get up and go play football outside yeah. of the country. And so, like, you could just kind of, you could feel how the football is just bringing people together who otherwise wouldn't be.
Yeah. And that was an amazing story. And when I first heard it told that he had gone and been escorted by these Nigerian militants to this fishing town in the Niger Delta so he could go scout kids, you know, I knew it had to be the opening scene of the book, because it captured how different this is than anything else you really ever see in the sports world. And so I wasn't with him in 2007 when he was standing on the dock in the Niger Delta and getting into that boat with the militants. But what I did was I went back in 2015 and I recreated the entire trip. I went with the same militants in the same kind of boat to the same fishing town, even walked through the town in the same way that he did to the field where he held the tryout. So I could describe it for the reader as if the reader is there, as if the reader is kind of watching it on a screen and seeing exactly what he went through. And that was a phenomenal experience for me. And I think, as I said, it really sort of captures the feeling of the book right from the beginning.
Do you think that you would have been able, or had the I guess, for lack of a better term, the chutzpah to actually do something like that? It's taken some courage in a dangerous situation. If you hadn't done your reporting in Pakistan and Libya?
Yeah, I think it would have been much more difficult. I mean, I spent a lot of time embedded with the troops in Afghanistan. In Iraq. I spent, as I said, a month with the rebels on the front line in Libya. So I was used to kind of dealing with quite, you know, dodgy situations. And so even though when I was in the Niger Delta, the kidnapping risk had come down some from when Colomer was first there in 2007, but it was definitely still there and you had to be careful and wary about it. But for me, it felt like a much safer environment than, you know, being with troops who are being shot at by the Taliban in southern Afghanistan. And so I agree. I think it was much easier for me to go take that kind of trip than it would probably be for a lot of people, because, you know, I'd spent a lot of time covering conflict in the past.
When you were doing the reporting for the book, Did you ever figure out from anyone you interviewed what was behind the selection of the countries that they started the initial outreach in? I'm always interested in that decision by Qatar.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a combination of, you know, where they thought really talented players came from. It was partly where they had connections to people on the ground, because you needed kind of quite strong connections to put these networks in place to hold the tryout. And they also wanted to kind of spread it around to different parts of Africa. So they had sort of some countries in West Africa, some countries in East Africa, and they had South Africa. Now, there were some countries in that first year that you would expect, if you were looking at from a purely soccer perspective, you would choose, like Ivory Coast, which wasn't in there. But Ivory Coast at the time was still a little unstable because right. It had gone through a civil war not that long before. And there were some rumblings and continued violence. So they didn't feel like it was safe enough to go to Ivory Coast. They ended up adding Ivory Coast in the second year once they felt like it had calmed down enough. And they had continued to have problems like that in Nigeria, for example. You know, once the militant Islamic militant violence in northern Nigeria got very bad in recent years, they had to stop going to northern Nigeria. And so it was those combinations of different factors that caused them to choose the countries that they went to first.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm always I like to compare the list of places where they've started the Aspire Academies to the list of votes that were on the FIFA X committee during the voting. And there's six or five or six that can kind of be linked to that.
Yeah, for sure. That was definitely a factor. So over time, as you know, they expanded not just within Africa, but outside of Africa. And as you said, a lot of the countries that they expanded to, both within and outside Africa, had, you know, members on the executive committee that were going to vote for who would host the World Cup in 2022. And I definitely think that was a political decision on their part, and they were trying to influence those votes.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to anybody about the emir of Qatar, the Sheikh Mohammed bin Al Thani, who basically every time I read a story about him, he kind of sounds like the young Trump or sugar daddy of Qatar when it comes to sports?
Yeah, I mean, Sheikh Mohammed, you know, he was a massive sports fan, and he was the one who was sort of the royal family's representative on the bid committee. I didn't focus on him as much because Sheikh Jassim, his brother, was the one that started Aspire and was the driving force behind Football Dreams. But I know that all of them were big sports fans because Sheikh Jassim, you know, they all lived in this massive royal palace complex in Doha that had, you know, sort of six Versailles-like palaces sort of spread across an area in the desert. And in the middle was this pristine soccer field, this sort of rectangle of emerald green that really sort of stood out among the desert around it. And they would all go play together on this field, the emir and his brother, Sheikh Jassim and Sheikh Mohammed. And so they were all big sports fans. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons they wanted to bring the World Cup to Qatar also, of course, because they knew it would attract the world's attention. And that was a small part of a much larger geopolitical strategy they had to use their wealth to sort of punch above their weight on the world stage.
So we've talked a little bit about, you know, the romance, but kind of continuing on with Qatar's role in the whole thing, there's the whole program from the beginning was kind of mired in controversy from the world perspective. Can you talk a little bit about why people thought it was, people were skeptical of the program?
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of people, especially in Africa, sort of viewed this as a form of neocolonialism. You know, you had this very rich country coming to a bunch of much poorer countries and sort of, in their view, effectively mining their most prized natural resources, their young, talented soccer players. And so many people feared that they were just going to take these kids and then give them passports and have them play for Qatar's national team. So they faced a real backlash because of that. And so had to sort of backpedal and say, well, we're not necessarily going to make these kids play for Qatar, but if they want to, you know, be up to them. And even FIFA, Sepp Blatter wrote a private letter to some members of the EU Parliament that were very concerned about this. And Sepp Blatter in the letter said, I agree, this is total exploitation. But then Sepp Blatter went and visited Qatar and visited Aspire and was sort of, I think, wined and dined by the Qataris. and he quickly changed his tune. And so they were sort of able to address the criticism that they were facing.
Yeah, that whole Sepp Blatter meeting, just to me, it reeked of
corruption.
Thank you.
That's okay.
It reeked of corruption. Do you think that, you know, this was just another example of it, or, you know, a sign of things to come?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sign of the influence that Qatar and its wealth had, for sure.
I think he left there with briefcases of money.
I don't know about that, but, you know, I know that, both the money that the Qataris had and sort of the influence they were building sort of among the other FIFA nations, which Sepp Blatter was very focused on because these nations vote who becomes president, that he was very much kind of sensitive to their power within the organization. And actually, one of the interesting things that I didn't even mention in my book, but there's a dinner I mentioned in the book where Sepp Blatter has dinner with the emir and then the Qatari member of the executive committee. And apparently at that dinner, Sepp Blatter sort of leaned back in his chair at the end of the dinner and said for the first time, why don't we bring the World Cup to Qatar? And so it was the first time he'd sort of raised this potential that Qatar would host the World Cup. It ended up working out well for Sepp Blatter because, you know, through a bunch of circuitous ways, he ended up losing his job because of the Qatar World Cup. And so he probably regrets that he ever brought it up at that dinner.
in kind of the years after that, I think weren't people afraid that Qatar was basically going to try to take and nationalize all of the students that are coming to the academy?
That was definitely a big fear. And so, again, they had to sort of backpedal and say, well, we're not necessarily going to force them to do this. And they said, you know, well, our main focus for bringing the kids here is not necessarily to naturalize them, but to have them train with the local Qatari players, because if the local Qatari players are training every day with players who are much better than them, then it's going to raise their level. But Qatar has a long history of using its wealth to lure foreign athletes into taking Qatari citizenship and representing the country in international competitions like the Olympics. I mean, they've done it with sort of every sport imaginable: Kenyan sprinters, Bulgarian weightlifters, my personal favorite, a Chinese chess grandmaster. and so I think that was their idea at the beginning. But I think both because of the criticism they faced and then also FIFA tightened the rules about naturalizing players, especially young players, which made it much more difficult for them to naturalize these players they were finding in Africa. So they eventually didn't naturalize any players of the program. I think the program became much more of a prestige project, that if they could find the next Messi, the next superstar in Africa, that, you know, that it would be sort of an international feather in their cap and they could say, mm-hmm. we have one of the best soccer development programs in the world. But if you look at Qatar's team, their national team, it's made up of, you know, like half African and half South American players. So they've continued to naturalize players from other countries for their national team, just not through this program. And I think it's partly because this program was so high profile that there was a spotlight on it. So they knew that if they did it through this program, they were going to get a lot of criticism, where if they sort of did it on the sidelines in the shadows, there wouldn't be as many people who would notice.
Yeah. And so they changed the regulation to be, I think you said 18 years, and then you have to live after that. You have to live in the country 5 years before you can switch.
Exactly. And some people call this the Qatar rule, because Qatar had tried to buy three Brazilian players for the 2006 World Cup, pay them like $1 million each or something. And FIFA became quite concerned that if you could just have wealthy countries going around and scooping up players like that, then what would the World Cup really become? And so that was one of the reasons they decided to tighten the rules.
I think it's also interesting that, you know, they're bringing in all these really talented players to inspire their national team kids, but their kids come from such privilege that they just actually kind of had the opposite effect is from.
Yeah. Well, the kids, yeah. When I spoke to the Football Dreams kids, they said they showed up and they got a very cool reception from the Qatari players, because the Qatari players also thought that here were these African kids, super talented, who were just here to steal our jobs on the national team. And as you said, I mean, there were kids being dropped off by chauffeurs and Ferraris and Bentleys to go to soccer practice. And so the European coaches who'd been hired by Aspire to coach them said they just didn't have the same drive as, you know, especially these African kids who are coming to the academy. And so they were just kind of on a very different level.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the book. I'm kind of curious about the three, like Dustin said, I've listened to, a couple other interviews you did today. And then I listened to some, I've obviously was flaming angry when they announced that Qatar won the World Cup. But, whenever, these players actually arrived there, like which of these three, or could you say was, I mean, like you mentioned, there's a lot of adversity that's driving these players. Has there been success for, the hundreds, or I guess it's 3.5 million that have been scouted in total? What's the success like when someone does go through the academy? Do they have a, cause most academies are run through a professional club, and this one's much different in that it's sponsored by more of the national federation almost. So what type of paths do they take once they hit that 18 years where they can sign their first contract?
Yeah. So basically what happened was, Joseph Colomer, who was running the program, was trying to figure out exactly that question. What do I do with these kids once they turn 18 and they're at the end of their time at the academy? And so what they ended up doing is actually going to Belgium and buying a team, to serve as a farm team for these African kids so that they could leave the academy, go play professional for a few years for this Belgian team, and then hopefully then go to on to some of the biggest clubs in the world. And it was one of the most fascinating parts of the story, because all of a sudden the residents of this, you know, small town in Belgium called Eupen that only had 20,000 residents sort of woke up one morning and their local team, the Pandas, was owned by some Middle Eastern country they had never heard of, and filled with African teenagers. And so it was a pretty stunning development for the folks in the town. But, you know, some of the kids have had success. You know, one of the players I write about in my book, you know, went from the academy to this team in Belgium and then ultimately on to Barcelona. And another player has made that same kind of move and ended up at Everton. But there have been many who have not made it. And that's a combination of a variety of factors. One, it's just incredibly difficult to choose which young player has the potential to become a star. You know, even when you're scouting millions of kids, I weave into the narrative of these kids that they found a discussion of the science of searching for talent. There's been a lot of research in the last 15, 20 years about what makes a great player and what should scouts be looking for. But the kind of short answer to a long question is that it is very difficult to kind of pick the right kid at a young age. But in Africa, it can be especially difficult because of some things about kids lying about their ages and saying that they're much younger than they actually are so that they seem better than they are. That sort of makes it more difficult. And so, you know, the short answer is that there were some kids that succeeded, but there were many more that didn't. And that's not only true of this program, that's true of sort of elite academies around the world. If you look at the Premier League, the percentage of kids at those academies who make it from the youth level to the first team is 0.5%. So it's a pretty hard road.
You talked about, the age cheating there. What is FIFA doing? Like, how do you combat that? And like, I know it's pretty prevalent in like Little League baseball here. We get like you get a kid who's supposed to be, you know, 9 years old, but he's in actually 13 coming into from, you know, a Caribbean country or something. What does FIFA do to combat that? And what does the sports world in general do?
Yeah, I mean, FIFA has tried to combat it, especially at, you know, kind of the under 17, under 20 World Cups. What they've done is they have instituted this MRI wrist test. That what they do is they take an MRI of a player's wrist, and you have growth plates in your wrist. And FIFA, their doctors that they work with, have said that if the growth plate is fused, then there's like a 99% chance that the player is over 17. And so that's what they've instituted. Although from folks I've heard, you know, talk to who are part of that world, they say the implementation is perhaps not 100% still there. And so I think you may still have overage players at some of these tournaments. And, you know, it's very easy for kids in many African countries to fake passports or get real passports with fake information.
Wasn't the biggest case of this actually Freddie Adu when he first started playing? I remember people saying he's not 14, he's 18 or he's 20, just because he looked older.
Yeah, there's a lot of suspicion. I don't know about Freddie Adu in particular, but I mean, for example, one of the kids in I write about in my book, he's not a main character, but he's an interesting character. You know, I discovered that he wasn't 13 when he tried out for Aspire. He was 21. And he went on to become the captain of the under 17 Ivory Coast national team at the World Cup at the age of 24. And so you know, it's still very prevalent.
And what does that mean to, like, so if you say you're 13 and you're, you know, a standout player, you're supposed to just keep getting better. But if you're actually 21, your development's, you know, going to slow down at a, you know, at a high rate as you get into your 20s. So, like, is there actually any benefit to these kids saying that they're older beyond just getting in the foot in the door?
Well, I mean, I think that there are now 13 to 21. That's an extreme, difference. I mean, you know, 13 to 16, 13 to 17, something like that. You know, I think that there are players, you know, who have lied about their ages and succeeded at the highest levels in Europe. And so I think it doesn't mean that a player's chance is zero if they're lying about their age. It just means that the probability of success is probably lower than it would be for a kid who is really 13. And even for a kid who's really 13, it's already really low. And so I think it just probably means they have less of a chance. But again, the chance isn't zero. And for these players, any chance that's non-zero is better than, you know, what they view as kind of their alternative reality, staying at home where they're from. And so they're willing to take the risk. They're willing to do anything it takes to have a shot at making it to Europe.
So on this academy, these coaches that they hired, the biggest name that's really associated with the Qataris now is Xavi. And he's the huge headline that people go for, especially right at the height of 2010. He's up there with Messi as the best in the world. Where do, and the German, I forget his name, that you write about that kind of helps start the program from an administrative point of view. What type of sell do these guys go for? I see that Claude Makélélé is coaching the Belgian team. Like, these are big name potential World Cup winners that are out there coaching these teams. Like, what type of, do they feel like mercenaries at times, or do they just kind of, they were mercenaries and they were professionals, so it just kind of goes hand in hand with the territory, or do coaches feel the same?
They probably all have different motivations. I mean, I'm sure money is obviously an important factor. I mean, the Qataris tend to pay at higher rates than a lot of other jobs in soccer. You know, Xavi, for example, I'm a big Barcelona fan, so I'm a big Xavi fan. You know, Xavi was sort of following in Guardiola's footsteps. You know, Guardiola went over to Qatar actually as well after he finished his European career. And it was what he saw as a path to becoming a coach, because he went and was sort of like a player coach in Qatar before he came back to Europe and started coaching Europe. I think Xavi will do the same. But Qatar has attracted a lot of high-profile players. Raul was there before Xavi. You know, I think a lot of these guys, again, it's a big payday at the very end of their career. And even for the coaches and scouts that are not as famous as Xavi and Raul and Guardiola, you know, the money they can make in Qatar is better than the, what they could make in Europe. So it's just a very attractive proposition for them.
Gotcha.
So before we move on to talk more about scouting and, mm-hmm. and development in general, what is this, the current state of the Aspire program? Like, is it, it's had all this controversy. Is it still thriving?
Yeah. So the Football Dreams program I write about, they suspended the search at the end of 2016 after 10 years, because they said they wanted to sort of evaluate how it's gone. Mm-hmm. They still have the way that they were training these kids. At first, they were just bringing some of the big Aspire Academy they have in Doha. But then they set up a satellite academy in Africa, where in Senegal specifically, where they were training these Football Dreams kids. That satellite academy is still operating. And so they're still training all of these African kids that they found. And they still own the team in Belgium. So they're still sending the best players from the program to Belgium. And so that's all, you know, continuing apace. And then, you know, the other controversy around the World Cup in general, you know, obviously, it's a big black eye for Qatar, but it hasn't stopped them from continuing to build stadiums and doing the other things that they're doing to get prepared for 2022.
Interesting.
Go ahead, Dustin. And before we get there, I just wanted to ask one quick thing to kind of bring everything that you've talked about as far as your experience and before writing about soccer, kind of to a heed, which is Qatar is an interesting, place right now, mm-hmm. with in the Middle East, with whether it's there's a bunch of boycotting nations against them, mm-hmm. and if you look at the landscape, I mean, they kind of put a big bet that national team soccer would be where the big focus was, and it mm-hmm. clearly has moved more towards emphasizing club soccer. And mm-hmm. so can you kind of contrast the style that the Qataris went about developing their program versus the way that Abu Dhabi went about with Man City and the City mm-hmm. Sports Group, and kind of two different paths right around the same time? And I mean, it's pretty clear that one's gotten under the radar, but has much greater success than another.
Yeah. Although I wouldn't say that Qatar has totally not followed that same path. I mean, they own PSG. You know, they were the sponsor for Barcelona, for a while. And so they, you know, PSG hasn't had quite as much success as Man City, although they're both still waiting to win the Champions League. But they have also, you know, kind of placed bets on club soccer as well as national team soccer. The difference really is that the, you know, Emiratis haven't sort of placed the bet on national soccer like the Qataris have. They haven't launched any massive program like this to try and produce a national team that could actually compete at the world level. But the Qataris, just like the Emiratis, see that, you know, again, soccer is sort of the ultimate form of soft power these days. And, you know, if you can develop either a great national team, or you're the owner of some of the top club teams in the world, you're going to get a lot of attention. And that's, you know, a goal of both Emiratis and the Qataris. So I don't think that they're so different in the way they've approached soccer to some extent. It's just really the kind of extreme focus on the national team that the Qataris have had, which is accelerated after getting the 2022 World Cup.
Yeah, I guess the World Cup's not a bad notch on the belt, so to speak.
Right.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, I guess you could say modern scouting, and some of the things that have you've learned from mm-hmm. just researching for the book. You talk a little bit about some of the challenges with finding, you know, the right talent, and you talk about Malcolm Gladwell's relative age effect mm-hmm. that he wrote about with Canadian hockey. Mm-hmm. Is that a thing in soccer? Mm-hmm. I mean, some people say it's not, but in your opinion,
it's not even me just saying, I mean, there's lots of conclusive evidence that the relative age effect is a huge problem in soccer. I mean, there's tons of academic papers that have, you know, shown this by looking at the relative ages of players. And, you know, for example, in England, professional players in England, I think that they found that you know, like 60% of them were born in the sort of the first quarter of the selection year. And so you have this problem in soccer, like you do in hockey, where scouts, they tend to pick the sort of relatively older kids because the kids tend to be bigger, faster, stronger. And that's a very bad scouting method because, you're effectively leaving out, potentially the kids who have the most potential, because once they catch up physically, they are often the ones who succeed because they've found ways to compensate for their smaller size over the years. And Messi is a great example. When he went to Barcelona at the age of 13, he was really small. In fact, he was so small that when he first showed up, the youth team coach gathered the other players on his youth team, which included like Sergio Busquets and Gerard Piquet. And he said, you know, we've got this new skinny kid from Argentina. He's really small. Please don't kick him too hard. We don't want to hurt him. And then Piqué yells out to the coach, kick him. We can't even catch him. And so, but Messi was so small, but he had to figure out a way to compensate for his size. And he did. And so once he grew, I mean, obviously Messi's only 5'7", so he didn't become a giant, but he became, you know, bigger and stronger. He had all of those other skills that he'd developed to compensate for his size that helped him. And even though researchers have found that in professional leagues around the world, that it tends to be the kind of relatively older players or the players that were born early in the selection year who tend to get selected for academies and tend to then make it to become professionals. They did a study that looked at players who were selected to be finalists for the Ballon d'Or, FIFA World Player of the Year award. And they found that actually those players tend to be born later in the selection year, not earlier. So it was precisely the ones who, again, needed to compensate for their small size who ended up being the most successful overall.
In the book, you talk about game intelligence and how a lot of the players in the poorer areas that play street soccer or, you know, beach soccer. Talk a little bit about how that type of upbringing and that type of soccer pedigree can develop a player's game intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, so as you said, basically, you know, what researchers have discovered is that, you know, scouts at a young age really shouldn't be focused on physical characteristics like size, strength, speed. I mean, speed is probably the most useful metric, but even it is not going to tell you much about whether a kid really has the potential to make it. You know, technique is more important, but it's really the mental factors like personality and game intelligence that are really the biggest determinants of a player's potential. And game intelligence you can think of as just, you know, the ability to evaluate a very dynamic situation in sports and make split-second decisions that tend to be the right decisions. And it's the hallmark of sporting genius, not just in soccer, but kind of every sport. And what they've discovered with kids is that the best way for kids to develop game intelligence is not necessarily formal practice or games. It's pickup soccer. It's the kind of street soccer that you see kids playing so much of in Africa and South America. And they think the reason that is because these are games that are often played in kind of smaller areas. So tight spaces, they have to have quick reaction times, quick thinking, and then it's unstructured. So that players have to come up with the solutions that they're faced to the problems they're faced on the field themselves. They don't have a coach just sort of telling them to do this or run there. And they think that helps players become more creative. It helps them solve the problems that they face when they're on the field. And so, and the interesting thing is that now they're starting to, with the sort of more high-tech analytics, you know, sort of Moneyball-esque that they're developing in soccer, they're starting now to develop some metrics to measure a player's game intelligence. And so that will be interesting to see over time as those become more sophisticated and then filter down to the youth level, is if you could come up with a young player's measure of game intelligence and see whether is that really representative, does that really sort of determine whether or not that kid is the one who's going to make it over time. And that's just now kind of getting to the point where the technology's starting to get good enough to do that. So sort of in the next 10 to 15 years. It will be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Yeah, we have a couple listeners that are big into the statistical analysis scene here with the MLS. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask a little bit more about the game intelligence stats. Like, what kind of stuff did you find out, what type of things those take into account at all? Or
yeah, basically there's a bunch of different ones that people are developing, but it's kind of like, if you think about it, it's a measure of, they're kind of measuring the sort of space around players on the field. I mean, they have all this tracking data of both every individual player and the ball through all of the cameras that they have around the field at the highest levels of the sport. And so what they can do is figure out effectively how efficiently a player is using the space around them. And that could be either from an offensive or a defensive perspective. So they could figure out whether, given the way that the players are situated on the field at any one moment, is a player making the right pass? Is a player making the right run, the right dribble? Is a defensive player cutting off the flow of play in the most efficient manner? So again, it's all through kind of measuring the way the space around the player relative to each other and relative to the ball is kind of changing throughout the game. And there's some kind of, sophisticated kind of math that's behind it, but that's the sort of general principle. Because, you know, the problem with so many metrics that they've had in soccer up until now is they've mostly been ball related. Mm-hmm. So, you know, expected goals, expected assists, that kind of stuff is still a ball centric metric, but 99% of what is important in a soccer game happens off the ball. And that hasn't been measured as well, up to now, but now with the more sophisticated tracking data of both the players and the ball that exists at the highest levels of sport, they're starting to be able to take that movement off the ball into account in some of their measurements.
That's super interesting. I think one of the things that was at least kind of got me to chuckle a little bit was the attempt by clubs like Borussia Dortmund, and I think there was another one in either Spain or Portugal you mentioned, that has, they're trying to simulate this game intelligence, the street soccer, with using this machine called a Footbonaut.
Yeah. Borussia Dortmund.
I looked up a video. It's hilarious. Tell us a little bit about that and why they think that it can help.
Yeah. So basically the Footbonaut is kind of this, think of it as like a square room where there's kind of AstroTurf on the floor and the player stands in the middle of the AstroTurf, and then around him, the walls are all made up of panels. I think it's like three levels high. And the panels are kind of these squares that can light up. And so what happens is they have a machine that kind of shoots the ball at the player, almost like a tennis ball machine shoots balls out. It can come to the player from any of the four directions. And the player has to quickly trap it and then pass it or, you know, shoot it into one of the squares that lights up on the wall. And so it's sort of trying to replicate that kind of dynamic situation in a game where you sort of a player quickly gets the ball, has to trap it, control it, and then quickly play a pass to the right, you know, teammate. And so they think that, you know, this machine will help players, again, sort of develop that game intelligence. It's not obviously exactly a game situation, but they think replicate some of the thinking that players have to do on the field.
Getting some of that stimulus and turning it into action.
Right.
The goal from the 2014 World Cup was scored by Mario Götze that won it. Mm-hmm. And he credited his work at Dortmund on the Footbonaut with his. Yeah. And if you look at it, you're like, yeah, that's a weird ball to control. Like, he's right at the edge. It's on his left side, probably his weaker foot at the time. And yeah, he admits like, yeah, if I hadn't have had that type of practice, it probably wouldn't have controlled it as quickly as I did. It probably would have just run out of bounds instead of getting a shot.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the other thing, just to kind of talk a little bit more about game intelligence, because I find it very interesting as a player, sort of how game intelligence works, sort of what's really going on in the brain. And I talk about a figure in the book named Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel Prize winning behavioral economist. And he wrote a book recently called Thinking Fast and Slow, which is about kind of how the brain thinks or processes information. And he talks about that there's sort of system one and system two thinking. And system one thinking is very fast, but not very sophisticated. It's sort of, it's almost what we think of as emotions or things like breathing, which are almost instinctual. And then system two thinking is slow, but it's good at problem solving. So like doing a math problem or filling out your tax form. And basically what a soccer player needs to do is they need to do system two thinking, so complex system thinking, at system one speed. And that's a very difficult thing to do. But what they've discovered is that through thousands of hours of practice, that experts are able to transform system two thinking into system one thinking. So the example they give are chess grandmasters. The chess grandmasters are able to look at a chessboard, and within seconds, they know what the strongest move is. Now, soccer players are no different. And what they've discovered, because a soccer player, you know, you think about Iniesta, when he gets the ball and he looks up, he immediately knows where he should play it. And chess grandmasters, the way they do this is they sort of memorize chunks of the board. And a grandmaster might have 300,000 chunks kind of memorized in their head. And so when they look down at the board, they recognize a pattern. So they immediately know the right moves. Well, it's the same for soccer players. You know, soccer players play thousands of hours, maybe starting with pickup soccer when they're kids and then going into a more formal system if they make it into academy. And so they're doing the same thing. They're kind of memorizing kind of chunks of the field. And so when they look up, they're seeing kind of recognized patterns of players around them. And so they immediately know the right pass or the right run or the right shot because they've seen that situation before. And so that's how they think sort of the game intelligence of soccer players is similar to, say, the game intelligence of chess grandmasters that allows them to, again, do very complex thinking, but incredibly quickly.
Yeah, I think the hockey referees do something similar in order to get like accustomed to the speed of the game. They'll like go in virtual reality or watch videos at like six times the speed and try to make calls based on that.
Oh, it's interesting.
I can't quote exactly where I saw that, but I saw a video on it once, which makes me an expert.
As a tax accountant, I actually do tax returns six times faster than most people actually do them. So yeah, I do them in my sleep.
Yeah.
No, it's funny you say that about the street soccer. I think it's kind of funny that Americans try it because we like to, as far as sports go now, it's such a trend to try to quantify everything. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to a European, it's a lot of the same type of quantifying is not a bad thing necessarily, mm-hmm. but like when you read what Germany did, it was more so about just getting professionally trained coaches out about with kids. And then when you talk to somebody from South America, Tim Vickery always talks about the Uruguay national team and how there's this tiny nation of Uruguay, but they continually produce world-class players. And it's because they want their players at a very young age to play a certain style in a certain way. And mm-hmm. so they kind of tell them, hey, look, you're not going to be an Ibrahimovic or whatever. Mm-hmm. We want you to play quick. Mm-hmm. I think is what he basically says. It says, be quick, think quick, and act quick. Right. So you're quick pace, you think fast, and you're able to execute quickly. And that's kind of like what they've built it on. So it's kind of funny to see everything. It's kind of all clashes to some extent.
Right.
When you look at Americans, they're getting there. We're getting there. But
it's, you know, it's interesting because I was talking with Sunil Gulati a few weeks ago, the former U.S. Mm-hmm. the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation. And I was talking about this sort of game intelligence and link to pick up soccer. And he says, yeah, that's something that we've really struggled with at sort of the highest levels of youth soccer in the U.S. because, you know, the youth system in the U.S. is very formalized. And he understands he's an academic himself, so he sort of read the studies and understands the research has shown how valuable pickup soccer it can be. But it's not really part of our culture as much as it is, as say, places in Africa or South America. And he said, so one of the things they've been grappling with is how do you structure unstructured play? You know, how do you try and recreate the same kind of feeling of pickup soccer, of small-sided games in a more formalized system like what the U.S. has. And that's kind of, it's like an interesting academic exercise to sort of figure out how you do that.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what would happen if a Phil Knight or somebody like that just decided one day, I'm going to spend $5 billion over the next 10 years on soccer for kids that are 14 and younger.
Right, right.
And just found somebody to build out soccer infrastructure, whether it's just fields and then throwing balls and pumps out there and see what happens. But
I mean, that was the amazing thing for me traveling across West Africa. I spent like 5 months in West Africa doing research for the book, is that there you see kids playing everywhere. I mean, like, you know, the cities are increasingly crowded in Africa, so there's not that much space for kids to play anymore. And so, but you'll see them take advantage of even the smallest place. I mean, probably one of the most sort of shocking or memorable for me was seeing kids playing a pickup game in a cemetery in Ghana, because again, like it just was the only area that they had to play. And so they were actually playing within the tombstones, you know, like, I mean, it was just an amazing image. And so, again, you sort of realize how much they're playing and sort of how passionate they are to for the game. So it just, I think it makes a big difference in their development.
Well, so you played college soccer. You've been through the old system when it was that way. What types of advantages? I mean, I like to follow the development academies and the way that those are being run. One of your old teammates, Jesse Marsh, his team's got a great academy. So what type of, would you say that they are at least getting the tech? Because I feel like Sunil would admit that talent identification, kind of what the ultimate goal was of football dreams, was identifying talent. And with a country as big as we are, wouldn't just identifying the talent, if they're going to play in the streets on their own or do whatever, as long as they have the skills, I guess U.S. soccer doesn't really care how they develop them as long as they can find those players, though.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of ideally you need a kid who grows up playing a lot of pickup soccer. But then, you identify him, you know, there's no probably magic age, but, you know, maybe it's 11, 12, 13, 14. I don't know. And get them into then a formalized academy system where they can learn the tactical side of the game that they're not going to get, you know, just necessarily playing in the street, and you need both these days. But, you know, I think, you know, the benefit these days in the U.S., and I'm sure it'll prove even more, is sort of what you mentioned about Germany. I mean, there's sort of many more kind of well-trained coaches than, say, when I was growing up.
Right.
You know, and that's a big difference, you know, so that at least even if a kid isn't in, you know, yet in a sort of an MLS academy, that at the youngest levels, they at least have coaches who understand a game a lot more than the coaches did when I was growing up. And that's a big difference that I see. And I think that will only improve as soccer becomes sort of more embedded in the U.S. But, you know, I think it's going to be evolution. I think the interplay between the MLS and the academy systems and, say, college soccer is going to continue to evolve, because obviously there've been a lot of criticisms of college soccer and that, you know, it doesn't allow players to play enough and develop enough. And, you know, will we see sort of more of an NBA type system where you have more players sort of not going to college and going straight into the MLS, you know, probably, but I think they'll still continue to be a place for college soccer because, as I write in my book, again, the percentage of players that make it is really small, and players do need to think seriously about kind of what kind of safety net do they have in place if it doesn't work out for them, whether that's because they're not good enough or they get injured or whatever. And college is obviously a college education is obviously an important component of that.
Yeah, but I would agree with, I think it's FC Dallas at least does a really good job of blending in kind of the way that they do that background or sorry, the fallback plan is safety net is they kind of keep a small community in terms of what type of well, what type of kid they are, what they want to do and their goals and dreams. And they kind of are realistic. We talked to Reggie Cannon, who's 19 and only did a year of college last week, but he said that Oscar actually, the coach actually just sat down with him and said, you're not ready. And so clubs kind of have to take that responsibility, which is, what kind of puts the entire Qatar thing, Aspire Academy, in stark contrast, because they were looking for, they want to make the family better, send them a couple grand or a couple thousand each month, but they wanted somebody that they could call the next Messi or put on some banner and sell some shirts. So it's different to see.
No, I appreciate any place that, again, is doing serious thinking about, you know, again, that, that, most players aren't going to make it. And, you know, what's going to happen to the players who don't make it, not just what's going to happen to the players are good enough to become stars.
I agree. Dustin, you got anything else?
I'm good. This has been great. So thank you for joining us, Sebastian.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And the book is called The Away Game, The Epic Search for Soccer's Next Superstars. I listened to it on Audible on my commute, and it was great. I was sitting in the car with my notepad, just scribbling notes to just things, questions that came up as I was reading it. And any book that can get me thinking about, it can get my brain going like that is an A-plus in my book. So, yes.
Well, I'm glad you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Sebastian.